This is Thursday, October 18th, 2007. This is Leanne Diakoff. I'm interviewing James Ogden Stiles, who was first lieutenant in the 5th Air Force, 22nd Bomb Group, 408 Squadron, served in World War II, the Pacific Campaign. This is our second interview, continuing from our interview of last week regarding Mr. Stiles' service in World War II. Now, Mr. Stiles, last week we kind of rushed at the end through your service in the Pacific arena and your return home, but I'd like to back up and talk a little bit more about your specific service there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I give a correction or straighten out. It's not a correction, but the first lieutenant, I was not commissioned the first lieutenant until I got home and got in the reserves right in 1946.
Okay.
I was a second lieutenant all the way till 46, and then I was commissioned a first lieutenant when I got in the reserves.
Okay.
And for a five-year period, I think I was in. So it wasn't, I didn't have the action in time as a first lieutenant. I didn't get that until after I came back.
So you were second lieutenant during your service?
During the service overseas.
Overseas, okay. That will be noted in our interview here. Let's back up to when you were going to the Pacific. You had met your crew in California. I think you said there were about five of you that were assigned to a plane.
No, it was 10 of us.
10 of you assigned mm-hmm. to a plane. Tell me about the plane that you flew overseas and that you used on your missions, and just kind of describe to me, you know, where you would sit and what kind of movement you had in the plane.
We were receiving crew training at Marchfield, California, Riverside, California, and there were 10 to a crew, and the four officers were all second lieutenants. Clifford Beans, the pilot, Chuck Arm Brewster was the second lieutenant, and Steve Morrill was a bombardier, and he was from California, and I was a second lieutenant navigator. And then the rest of the crew were enlisted men, had a engineer, Notismeyer, and radio man, Red Benton. He was from Benton, Arkansas, which is where Walmart started. I believe I mentioned that the other day. He grew up in Benton. And we started there in the whole fall of 44. And trained there until about the first, about the January or first part of February of 45. And we were, our training was in a B-24 where we practiced bomb dropping and out over Muroc Desert and Salton Sea, which were locations over the, in the, they were east of the mountains from San Francisco, from Los Angeles, and had that and some, but mostly bomb dropping. We'd all had gunnery at other locations, and during that time, the navigator, you wanted to know where the positions were there, in that.
Yeah, where were you? Where were you situated
in the plane? It changed from model to model, but in these earlier models, the navigator was up in behind the nose gunner. He had a little, like a little office. He had the astrodome overhead for shooting celestial shots, and a table, folding down table, and it had all the compasses and wind speed instruments and directions and such as that, but I don't know all the terms as closely as I did then, but that's been almost 60 years, so it's a long time to remember all the details. Mm-hmm. But I remember all those people. I've got a, it's just hanging in the other room, I've got a, that whole crew, and are their names, and I don't know if you'd want to, me to, you to see it or not, or you wouldn't need to.
At the close of the interview.
Hmm? I can just get it in a minute.
Let me pause this. Okay, we're back, and you've shared with me a photo of your crew on your B-24. So you had this little office behind the, did you say gunner?
The nose gunner.
The nose gunner.
They can't see it on that plane.
And how big a space is that? Were you confined to that space?
About this, well, you stretch your arms across, probably up in the nose, it tapers to the front, mm-hmm. and the nose gunner is on that in the front of that, and it opens up into this little navigator's place. This little table was about like this. Mm-hmm. These maps I had out spread out on that table, and made all my guides on that by the table.
And were you confined to that little space throughout the mission, or throughout a flight, or could you get up and?
We could get up. Yeah, it was over water, but on a mission, it'd be usually be up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of them when we had raided Shanghai. It was a pretty big raid. I think I noticed on a note I had there. I think it was a 500 plane raid on Shanghai. And then we had one on Hong Kong, and one to Canton. They were all at Japanese aircraft locations.
And so these would be air raids where you said a 500 plane raid. 500 similar planes would go out with you, and you all would.
Oh, we'd be out as a group. There'd be probably. The 22nd Bomb Group would go out. We'd have squadrons. I was in the 408th Squadron, and there would be about four squadrons to a group, and you'd have a group of, they'd be flying in probably fours of four, and B-12 to 16, I'd just there on the group, and then the several groups would go out and on a mission together, and we'd all have a time to where to be in the formation and how long to be on toward the target. And the thing in the South Pacific when I was there, we had flak out of those 18 missions. We had flak about probably about eight times is all, because the in the Pacific, the toughest thing I have is the weather. There's always storms coming up, and they had one from I think it was one from Hong Kong. It was ran into a storm coming back from the mission. And going back to Philippines, and we just tossed and turned. I was in that front compartment, and it was just the door of that front gun would keep blowing. The winds were so strong that wind would just blow the door open, and wind would come into that room and blow maps around and everything. But the sad part was that we ended up not knowing where five planes went. They just didn't get back. They got lost or something. And anyway, I never heard what happened to them. They just never know where they landed somewhere else or missed the island and didn't. It just ended up out at sea somewhere. But
so no one
never did.
Anybody
ever knows what happened to him. But that happened in weather a lot, and it's always had storms every afternoon in Philippines. But
how were you able to navigate back through a storm? I think you had mentioned before that you did a lot of constellation.
You wouldn't have that. No, you would just use the drifting wind and from the weather reports we had. And you can see the land on the, in these storms, even coming in. You wouldn't come into the storms until you got in Luzon, the island, and you could see all right. We would be at a lower altitude, then we got that. But before that, it's interesting to see how you can. You wouldn't think you could fly by pilotage or by land content or contact. With the land, but you couldn't. And one of the things that's interesting, that when you're flying from the Philippines up to Formosa, for instance, there were little islands that are submerged. You can't see them from on the ground. If you're on a ship, you couldn't see these little islands. But if you know, there's a just like a string of islands that you can see from the air, and really have them placed on the map. This is the lower end of Formosa, and then you fly up. You have these islands like this that you can fly on this, and with your land contact here, and knowing what your airspeed is and the wind and this is the velocity of the wind and all those things, you can control your movements. Like we're aiming for this island over here, that's for Taiwan now, it's Formosa here on either side. We had bombing mains there and all the way up to the north. When we hit the most was the one up at the north of Formosa, Kiran. That's where the most of, that was the largest town then, and it's the largest one now. It's in Taiwan. And Tainan is, I think, the cost of it now, is the name of the town. But you can see these, a lot of these little islands are submerged. You can see just like a shadow under the ground, or under the water. And you could fly with those. These, and we were short on maps, and this one used, there, couldn't get them. I had several flights. You can see I've got pencil that I've moved or I've erased because I was going up here. I had a mission here and then no new maps for us. So we use this and have to erase out this and then fly up here and track my routes up to these various areas.
So after each mission you would erase your pencil and then marks have another, from that one so you could use the map again.
Get new information for weather and all of that, and but I had this. This is an old map here. It's Taiwan. They call it that now. Yeah. This is October 44, and it was all the figures were put in here in 1943, and we had it in 44 that was issued to us. Mm-hmm.
And you were using this on missions in 45, I think. Mm-hmm. And you were using this on missions even in 45.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that was, you couldn't get probably get any more dateful, mm-hmm. but as long as you had one that would still erase, you're all right.
Now, how long did some of these missions last? What would be a typical mission?
Well, as I remembered, they were about 8-10 hours. Let's see here. I got them in here somewhere.
Is this your flight log? Is that what you're looking
at? Yeah, I had these. Some of them I made myself after I was a navigator. I just put my own on here. Mm-hmm. And like here's a, that's still in Marchfield. This is navigation, gun bombing. Here we are, the hours. Like here's one, in flying overseas, when we flew a plane from brand new plane to go overseas. We ferried it over to New Guinea, to a little out to an island called Biak, and we flew from Mather Field, which is Sacramento, California, to John Rogers Field in Oahu, and that was 14 hours we flew that one. And from there to we went to Canton, to Tarawa to Los Negros, and Los Negros to Biak, which is where we landed that new plane, and then we flew to NADZAB, which was the field there. And the field, like here we go, from Kiran, Formosa, which is a long mission to the northern Formosa, was nine hours of flight time. And here's Clark Field to Kiran again. It's 9 hours. That's the farthest from Clark Field to northern Formosa. Hong Kong, Clark Field to Hong Kong was, well, it was all about 10. It was 9:50. And they were all about 9 hours. Most every one of them was 9 hours. Here's one from Clark Field to Haito, Formosa, was 11 hours. And one to Toyota, or here Canton, China, was 10 hours and 30 minutes. So they were all 8 to 10, 11 hours. So it was
And what was your communication? Could you communicate with navigators in the other planes
no.
in your squad?
No, we couldn't do that. No, we had we could communicate on the plane. We all had to keep our, we had a headset on. But we keep in communication with our crew members. And but if you take them off, you couldn't talk. Yeah. They'd have them on. And you had, so primarily the radio operator, the engineer, the two pilots, and the navigator was the most common communication. And others would maybe just ask a question or something like that. But those that I just mentioned were the ones that were mostly on the radio.
Was it loud in the plane?
Oh, was yeah. It? There's no, the side of a plane is about that thick. there's no insulation, knowing you're in passenger plane today, it's all thick wall, you know, it's air in it, a lot of insulation, and there was no heat at all whatsoever. It's just all open up to the wind. And
so these were pretty cold missions?
No, they weren't, because in the we were in the South Pacific, and most of our missions were about 15 to 16,000 feet. Now, if you were in Europe, friends of mine that flew over there, they would be at a higher altitude. They'd be up 25,000 feet and have to wear heavier clothes. When we were training, we used those heavy clothes in that March field. We had some missions that were our practice missions where we flew at 25,000 feet and had these heavy clothes on, all sheep lined. Mm-hmm. And but when we were assigned or routed to go to the South Pacific, we left all of that here. And the friends of mine that were going to Europe would have the heavy clothing. So it was pretty good to get to go south anyway. I had Miami Beach in the winter, and when I first started, and ended up in the Philippines coming home. So.
You only had that one little stint in Kansas.
Yeah, at Independence, Kansas. And it was snow there. That's the only snow we had.
But
they
got
whole
you
time
out of
I was
there
in.
Pretty fast, it sounds
yeah.
like.
Pretty good. Yeah, I was lucky.
Well, do you have any memories about these missions to Shanghai and Hong Kong? I mean, those were pretty large missions.
Yeah, in fact, the navigator is, they call him on the plane, he is the the crew member that spots all the hits of the bombs and such. And so we sat in the bomb bay when we were on the bombing run, leave where, and some of the planes by this time, we had a navigator's compartment up on right behind the pilot. And that was a newer model, which we had some of those. But the ones like I talked about coming back from Hong Kong, they were back, but you still had to go back to the bomb bay and sit there. The navigator was the one that was supposed to be the intelligence officer, for a briefing after the mission to have spotted all the hits. So we would sit up there, the navigator would sit there in that bomb bay, in an open bomb bay over, and then we would fly over the motion. We'd have already been briefed and with photographs and things of where the target is. And as we flew over the target, we watched those hits, where the bombs hit. And we came back and had the intelligence test of the hitting. Why, we would have an interview with the home officers, telling them where we thought they were hitting. So it kept it open there, and really was a quite a nice view of the
target. Yeah, so you would actually sit there as the doors opened?
Yeah, they open up the side, they slide up the side.
And you would be looking down?
Just looking down, and there's a catwalk. Right through the middle of the two of them. There's one on either side, mm-hmm. and you could load 4,000 pounds on either side. You could put in four 2,000-pound bombs, one in each bomb bay. But most of the missions, we used more quantity than a small, large tactical target. So we would, there would be fragment tests or bombs, but most of them would be about 500-pounders, mm-hmm. and they would be scattered out over a wide area and do more targets. And by this time of the war, we had a bombardier. All the planes had bombardiers, but we had gotten to the point where we were dropping our bombs on the lead bomber, rather than have every plane's bombardier taking the plane. They usually could take control of the plane with their bomb bombardier used it, an instrument that he would take control of the plane and help guide it in. But we got to the point, I think, in Europe and in Pacific, where it was better just to use the lead plane to lead the target, and all the rest of the planes would drop their bombs when the first plane dropped theirs. And then it would be a big scatter. It was scatter bombing. It was no real accuracy as far as that. It actually did better, because you spread out over, instead of several planes dropping at the same place and all the bombs going to a tight location, everybody was dropping their bombs at that scattered range.
So instead of picking out a target of like one factory or something, they'd scatter, would say, out over a 3-mile stretch of beach.
And it was much more effective than the other. And in the Pacific, one of the things that I believe I mentioned to you, one of the things that we were advantage of was that when we were opening, most all of our targets were on the sea shore. They were coastal cities, and we could make our bombing run approach from the sea and come in and not have to worry about flag at aircraft underneath us, because we would be out over the sea. And then as soon as we got to shoreline, then there would be anti-aircraft fire. But then we could get in on the bombing run and make that approach. And after we dropped our bomb, we would break out to the sea and leave that anti-aircraft flak after a fairly short run, compared with, I know my cousin Bob Stiles was in B-17s in Europe, and we had enlisted at the same time, and we both graduated from male high school at the same time, joined about the same time. But he was over in the bomb run for miles. They had and fighter planes. They had the whole German air fighter planes after him. And early in the war, when he got there about, he got to Europe about 5 or 6 months before I got to the Pacific, and they had bomb runs where they were really pounded, and he was shot up twice, and had his co-pilot killed once with a flak. I saw him after we came home, and I had seen him for a lot, and went to his wedding, and after he came back, and he had really been really wounded mentally about it, as if the his plane crew's getting shot up, and but it's one of those really tough routes. You don't know who got the choice to go where, but some's got in tough spots. Some got where the mission is different. It can still be fatal to a lot of people, but not with not that type of attack. Like I believe I was mentioning to you the numbers of planes where, like, we lose planes by weather. Mm-hmm. And they would be, you know, they just go, and it was nothing that you would really, you'd know that they disappeared in you, but you don't know where. And I believe I told you about after the war, when the General Swing was the cause for killing 20 of his troop carriers and 5 of our crewmen, and different type of thing. But there were still, it was all a different type of duty, but still, to me, my cousin, I always thought my cousin had probably the toughest of anybody I knew in the Air Force. And of course, infantry, they had no easy way to go, and so it's different. And one, you know, in the Air Force, you always flew home if you got back. You'd gotten home and got to a good meal and a good bed and good food and everything, and then you have a mission about every other day. And so it was a different type of thing.
Speaking about getting home to a bed and a meal between missions, what kind of accommodations did you have?
Well, we had just nice sturdy tents, and the one down in Adsab was in a jungle country, cut out of a jungle area, really. And this good sturdy tents and a tent mess center, and the food was, it's a miracle how the United States could send millions of men overseas, and we had food, we had clothing, we had ammunition, we had gasoline for the planes or the trucks, and how we could do that for the whole United Air Forces and Navy same way, and had to do that. I don't think it could ever be done again to field that kind of an army and have them that well equipped as they were. And the civilians themselves here, today's parents, if you go ask anyone out here in this neighborhood that are under 60, they would think this was just a terrible thing to have gasoline at $3 a gallon. But when my parents and my friend's parents were at home at that time, they had 5 gallons of gas a week for their planes. A week, 5 gallons. And that was all that the civilians could get. There was rationed. Food was rationed, meats were rationed, ketchup, all those things. And they would trade for these ration cards around with people, with neighbors that they needed food more than they did. They would trade with neighbors, and it was a tough thing. But the United States would never endure that again. They won't even endure $3 gas. So it is one thing that I have to say that I really have lost a lot of faith that the United States and its patriotism. I don't believe they're a very patriot country anymore. They all they want to do, and I'll have to. I used to be a Democrat, but back after I came back from the war and saw how the Democrat Party was, I could not believe that they could deteriorate themselves like they have. And today in Kentucky, the Democrats have been governors of this state for every year but four, just the current four, but they had 40 years straight of Democrats, and this state is just bad. And but the thing of it is that all the population is so spoiled, they think everything should be given to them. If there's a heavy rainstorm, they have to have somebody come in and clean it up. And I believe I was telling you about the flood here. Everybody here cleaned up their own mess. They didn't have the government send out people to clean up floods. And I think a lot of us who came back from service, and after we came home, went to college, and got in working, we were still pretty loyal people, but today not. You just can't find them. They're always crying, and I mentioned all these Democrat congressmen. I can't see how anybody can stand them, frankly. I know you don't like hearing these things about this, but there are a lot of friends that I have that are near my age or maybe a little younger than I that can't see this country's future very good because they're not willing to do anything but give each other everything and take it from each other.
Do you think there's not as much of a sense of community sacrifice?
None. There's no community. You know, like you have we had a flood in 37, everybody pitched in and helped each other. But you go down to any other place we have now, every time there's a heavy rain, well, we have to create a local emergency to help them drain the water off of the streets or the mud off of the streets. That's what they have to do. They won't do it themselves. So somebody has to do it, and that's what they want. But that's the way it is.
Well, you said that they were rationing food here in the U.S. for civilians. Mm-hmm. What were you eating in your camps?
Well, we had these different rations that were made, and it was good food. And at the airports and on the Navy ships, they had food that was ample and okay. But and of course, our foreign allies were shaped than we were. Mm-hmm. You take the British, really, they suffered tremendous amount of death and food loss and people getting bombed by the Germans. And the Russians just We've done a, Sue and I do have done a lot of traveling. After being in the service, I learned to educate myself by going to every foreign country I could. And Sue and I, we've been to Russia and Greece and France and England and everywhere around that area and into the Pacific. We've been to the Pacific and to Japan and Formosa. And the people there really suffered. The Russians, terrible. We went to Russia in about 1975, and when it was in the Cold War, and they just took 25 of us at a time, but they treated us well, they fed us well, but they told us and took us to the places that had been really through suffering. And Leningrad, it's now St. Petersburg, but it was under enemy and undercover and under surround by the Germans for 900 days there. And their diet was of dead rats and mice and birds and all of that, but they had no food. I don't know how they survived it, but they did. And they had a big mound, big park in the middle of the of Leningrad or St. Petersburg now, where they had a mass burial land, to use there. And it's just a mound out there that's been filled full of batteries. I think they had bodies. They had a million people killed in Leningrad. Mm-hmm. And they've suffered too. But, and then it made people then, not care for their enemies either. Like we went into to Germany and Dresden and bombed them to smithereens, you know. And you get to a point where you don't like anybody that bombs you. You don't like them, and so you're going to bomb them. So, but I guess right now you can in quite a way in Iraq, you can sympathize with these Iraqis, where Iraqis are killing Iraqis. You know, they just wonder what kind of brain power they have. And but we were killing everything. But you do it to survive. That's mm-hmm. what it is. It's a matter of survival.
Was that pretty much the mentality by the time you got to the South Pacific?
Yes, it was. We captured no Japanese. And you may have read some of the stories about that. And in the local courier, they've had some reviews that were very forthcoming and full tales of how the Japanese and Americans fought each other, mm-hmm. till that the Japanese were brutal and cruel. And in the manner in which they mutilated American bodies, it was almost like a command order to don't take any Japanese alive. Yes, you see what they're doing to your friends. So after that, when we took very few prisoners, and the Japanese were still being brutal in the Philippines right up to almost to the end of the war.
Yeah.
And they never got any kinder or any in fact, I think I told you when we went to the one day about the it was right the 14th or 15th of September, right after days after the atom bomb, and when we landed up there to get on a weather reconnaissance and stopped and got a refueling in a B-24 at Atsuki at Tokyo.
This was after the war had ended.
This after the war had ended, but how the Japanese suddenly turned gentlemen. They came out and met us with long tail suits and bowing to us and doing all these nice things that they knew how to do, but they had just started doing them again. But it was kind of a comedy to see them coming out being the nice gentlemen they were after being cruel only a month before.
Was that your first encounter with the Japanese? I guess.
Yes, it really is. Yeah, just to talk. Yeah, they were very nice to us. But the airport, we never. One of the things in, I think in the Air Corps and the Navy, you didn't have that personal contact. You had the people that really took that type of suffering were Marines and the infantry. They really get face to face with them. I've got a book here, or a review of a happening. My fellow, his brother, I knew him. This fellow I'm talking about, he's written a book or a review of his stay, and it's really something. I don't know, I've got it hidden away somewhere, but it's really something. And he was a Marine, and what they went through and around Iwo Jima and those areas was just really, really tough. And I always think about them. I wonder how I was so fortunate to not have to get into that, and somebody else, a friend of mine, was in it. Like I mentioned, telling you, ferrying back a POW, a fellow named Bob Dietrich, who had been a coal mine worker, forced laborer in Tokyo, in Japan. So everybody, he was from Louisville. I mean, I told you he was from Louisville, and how he got back, I have no idea how he took all that. Did he come back as a skeleton? But I don't know. I think I touched on how fortunate I thought I was growing up in the west end of the Louisville area. When I was young, it was a beautiful area of the city, and churches everywhere. You take on that just the one area where, from about four block area, there were about five churches. There was the, I was in the Boy Scouts at West Broadway Baptist at 49th Road and Broadway, and then the Methodist Church, the Lutheran Church, the Christian Church, Catholic Church, were all in just walking distance. And so it was, and the parks were pretty and everything to play. And my dad, I believe I told you, we never owned an automobile. And but Dad always had a job. He'd worked for the Federal Reserve Bank. And in World War I, he had gotten a short service in the Navy as a radio operator. They sent him to school at Harvard. Mm-hmm. I guess I told you that too. Yeah. But anyway, when we didn't have our bicycle, we had some things, but I never found out till I was a little older why Dad had these tight things. He was born in Buffalo, Kentucky, and his father died at about 7 years old, and he had some other family down there. His mother, her maiden name was Chenault, and she had a brother that lived down in that area in Buffalo, Kentucky. And but he had a sister, he had two sisters born and his older brother. But his oldest sister was, she was a widow, not a widow, she was just a maiden woman. She never married. And she, during the Depression came after in the 30s, so she was to make her own living there. But the saddest thing was his younger sister was named Carrie, and she was born blind. Her doctor who brought her birth dropped some medicine in the eye. That was the thing that they did then, and it burned her eyes out. So she never saw a thing in this world, and she died when she was about 70 years old. And her uncle, Joe Chenault, took care of her, the daughter, and our dad's sister. And but dad was having to, his older brother wouldn't help him, but dad took the whole family's raising on his own, which we didn't know earlier. We wondered why couldn't we have a car or something like that. Well, he was giving the money to help his two sisters survive. And then he used to take me down to that farm in Buffalo, where his Uncle Joe Chenault, and he had a dairy farm down there and some tobacco, but he took care of all of them. And he worked hard as that at the time in the Depression, if the farming was paying nothing. Yeah. And my dad always spent that money during those times to support his family. But there was no social care, you know, to take care of the government, the state, or nothing did that. Finally, when he did move to Louisville when he was about 11 years old, he brought his sister up here at the Blind School for the Blind over on Frankfort Avenue. Mm-hmm. Had her go over there, and she learned to braille and all, and read just all the time. And she loved music. She got a degree from the University of Louisville in music, and could listen to records when we go down and visit her in the country. And it was always a time to remember, but not with any great joy, but the fact that she was getting taken care of, but you always felt sorry for her well-being because of the fact that someone had never seen a tree, and so that was always tough. But after that, well, she just stayed down there in the country, and I hardly saw her any after I was 15 or so, because mm-hmm. At that time I was in high school, and you always have something else to do. And this, I'm sure, is not entertaining about the war, but you said you were interested in things about what happened before the war.
Yeah, before the war, about your family.
Yeah.
And this tape is for your family, too.
Yeah,
so.
And my family was good. My mom was good, and my brothers were good. And Dad was extremely intelligent. We got a letter from him from the man that used to be Halleck. His name was Halleck. He was a principal of Male High School back in the 1950s and such. And he had written a letter for Dad about his scholastic abilities and to introduce him to the Federal Reserve Bank. So he got a pretty good recognition there. And he insisted on Jack and Joe and I to do well at school, and he used to help us with the study. He would read to us when we were 3 years old, and so we would get a good amount out of all of our schooling. And we all graduated well, and I remember Male, and I was at 42, and I had some good professors, and that school at that time was just excellent. Most all of the teachers at Male High had been graduates of Harvard or Yale or Princeton and a lot of good schools. So all the three friends I've mentioned, Max and Roger and I, and others that I know, Ed Alvey and such, we all volunteered for service because it was an extremely patriotic school, and Spaniel and St. X, the whole city was, and the United States for that matter, for the most part. And we took the test that were required to fly or to be a naval officer. We all became officers in the Navy or the Army or Marines and Air Force, Navy. For the most part, there were some that didn't and were drafted, but the good portion of us enlisted. And after we came back, we all went to college, and we all did well at Mayo or at U of L or other schools around.
How did you keep in touch with your family when you were in the
service? I got a whole stack of letters down the stairs that every one I wrote, I didn't know my mother was keeping them, mm-hmm. but she kept every letter I ever wrote her. I've got them all down the stairs here. And my granddaughter takes great pride in reading those letters. I've loaned her boxes of those so she could read them to her. She's going to Eastern Kentucky University now, and that same desire to do well were passed along to my sons and my brother's children, and now my granddaughter. She just finished the first year at Eastern Kentucky and was a 0.4 or 4 point grade for her first grade. And she won an 8 week award to Harvard. So we just sent her up to Harvard this year. She went to Harvard for 8 weeks. She had 2 4-week sessions at up in Cambridge, and we were real proud of her for that, but and her. So that all lived with us, and
so then when it came to did your mother and father write you pretty frequently?
Oh yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. And your brothers who were in other areas, were they able to write to you?
Yes, they were. Yeah, and they all got in the service, mm-hmm. and my Jack, who's 2 years younger than I, he. Always wanted to fly. I believe I told you that too, how he got with the Cat Airline, the CIA.
A hard time he had a hard time getting in the cockpit there for a few years, didn't he?
Jack?
Yeah. He wasn't able to fly until what, Korea? Was that it?
Oh, he was lost? When he was with the CIA, in the Navy, he was on a carrier there. Mm-hmm. Oreski was that, and he was aircraft carrier pilot. And but he wanted to fly so much after the war, then he wanted to fly, and so flew with Cat Airline, or ended up Cat, and then Air America, they called it the second time. And and then Joe, he was 4.5 years younger than I, and so he volunteered too for the Korean War, and he was in a field artillery group as the target spotting plane. You know, so all three of us flew. And I was in the Air Corps, Jack in the Naval Air Corps, and Joe was in the spotting planes, these little light planes where they would go out and fly over the Japanese positions or the Koreans, and Koreans that they would target. But he would spot, he was a spotter for that, So each of us, for a 10-year period, one or two of us at one time were away, and Mom was, we talk about that, but she always seemed cheerful when we got home, but I'm sure she must have worried when we were all gone, but we all got back.
Did she ever say anything to you?
Hmm?
Did she ever say anything to you before you left, or give you any advice, or?
No.
Any?
No, she just said see you when you come home. She would just tell us she'd see us. And I had two leaves, one of a week time and one of a 2 week time. And every time we get home for a break before we got overseas, we come home, she would always have had great food to eat. She had saved her ration cards to have a lot of good to eat. But it was good. But I guess where we, I'm so glad all of us got an opportunity to go to college. We all, Joe, he volunteered to go. He'd already graduated from U of L Liberal Arts, and he had already been admitted to med school. And Murray Kinsman was the dean of the med school. And Joe asked him if he could go. He said, or should he stay and get in? And Kinsman said, no, Joe. He said, I'm proud of you. I'll let you go, but I promise I'll have a place for you when you get back. And he did. And so Joe graduated as an orthopedic surgeon and practiced for, I guess, about 40 years. He had his practice in Owensboro. My Jack, in between, after he got out of CIA, he was living in Japan, and he met a person over there that he knew, and they had made friends. And this fellow was not a pilot, but he was a executive with Philco Radio and such in Tokyo. And they got to be buddies. This fellow was from Atlanta, and he talked Jack into coming to Atlanta. He said, let's start a dry cleaning business. So they did, and they used their money to start a laundry and shirt laundry business. And they ended up, it was fashion clothing wear or something like that. And they ended up with 26 dry cleaning stores in Atlanta, and ended up with quite a few dollars of money. And after they'd had it for about 6 or 8 years, where this fellow, Jack wanted to be a missionary, which he did. He sold out his half of the dry cleaners and was going to the Atlanta First Baptist. And he ended up with some help from that church to start a orphanage in Kenya. And he was there, he just now retired. He's 80 now. And he was a mission in Nairobi for about 10, 15 years. So he's out of that. And he ended up very well. Then Joe, of course, was a doctor of orthopedic. And then I started working from U of L. I started listening with Sears Roebuck and Company. And I was with them for 40 years. And they had a system. General Robert Wood was the president from years ago. He had started profit sharing for everybody. If you were going to be with Louisville, you had to join his profit sharing plan, or you didn't need to work. He said, if you didn't like that, well, you don't need to work at Sears. So everybody did that. And we had to resign. If you ended up an executive at a certain level at Sears, you had to retire at 63, because they wanted young people to come along and not to keep the people there forever and ever. And he wanted young people to come along and take jobs and step up the line, which is what we all did. Until the federal government came in about 10 years ago and said, no, it was against the law to make you quit.
To make you retire young.
So I couldn't retire young. So you had to retire at 63, whether you liked it or not, at Sears. And so all of us did pretty well.
We're very fortunate. Did.
So we are. So we had it all the way from when we were little kids. We lived well and everything we did, we came out in pretty good shape. So,
well, what do you think? Well, let me ask you two questions, and then I'll kind of ask a larger question. But when you were in the Pacific, what did you do on your free time?
Free time? Missions? Oh, we would play basketball. We had some basketballs up, or volleyball.
You mentioned that you like sports.
What's a board game? My co-pilot used to always love that game. You know, where you go around, I forget what is it?
Like Monopoly, or?
No, it was a board game, just a little thing, and you had little pegs you go in. I don't know what that, he had me playing that with him every day.
Like backgammon?
No, it wasn't backgammon. It's a little peg game. But anyway, everybody played it, so they liked it. But, so it was just playing those games, basketball, volleyball, and there were people there that were being looking ahead to, we had a sergeant who, his duty was to keep the water well pump running. And so he was really quite a innovative guy. He went out and cut up pieces of stainless steel off of Jap planes that had been downed. And he would cut those up, and he would make a wristband for your watch and put your wings on it. I've got mine upstairs somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And but it's got your wings on that stainless steel, and he made the band to fit you. And I remember he made them for everybody, and I think everybody in the Air Force wanted them. Mm-hmm. But he charged us 10 pesos, which was $5.
Oh, he charged you for them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. That's it. Well, he was thinking ahead. So I don't know whether he saved it and came home or whether he used it to play poker. I don't know. But he was, that was his job. He never did have to fly or anything else. He just kept that water coming into Clark Field for our part of the field. But there were various air squadrons placed around that whole area. And so our 22nd bomb group, we were in that one area, so everybody had their mess hall and all that there. So, but there's really, I guess it kept us busy.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that the war had ended?
Yes, we were still at Clark Field, but they had canceled our missions for the next couple of days. We usually had them about every third day. We had a mission, but everything was closed. But they didn't tell us why. We're just stopping our missions for now. And we were just sitting outside our tent. We just finished eating at the mess hall and our tent, and we were just sitting around talking. And it came over the radio that for the whole field area there, our squadron area, that we had dropped an atom bomb in Japan. And oh man, we were all just happy as can be, because we never not to have to worry about a mission anymore. And then a couple of days later, they did another one, and then the war was over.
And they just told you over the loudspeaker, the war's over.
No, we had still plenty to do. But we had, I was going to say something else in there. It was over. And we had things we were going to do. We moved up to Okinawa, and we camped at a field called Yan Tan. And there was another field right next to it. I think I told you that's where a couple of those planes crashed. And we had went through a big storm there, flew back after that storm. There's another miracle of supply. Everything, practically all the food on that Okinawa island was destroyed, just blown away. They say, and I have read in recent papers that was the worst monsoon it had ever in that area. And so that they had food going for the most part, and they had planes flying in from Guam, and they were flying in supplies, I guess shuttling it from various places, and got it in. Within 2 days, they had enough food for us all to eat and take it in. It was just a miracle what they could do. It was a fantastic, and they made a lot of, they say, a lot of dumb mistakes, but to plan that for 10, 12 million men at one time to eat, to drive, to fly, to be clothed, to be warm, it was just amazing that they could do that. So it's, but again, it's, I don't think it'd ever be done again.
When did they tell you you could go home?
Well, it was a sundown, sunset mission, So we all went back down to Clark Field, and they had it was a beautiful quarters there. It was the same as it was before the Japanese took it. When the Japanese took that, they didn't wreck those buildings either. All those quarters were still there, and you're ready to use. Even the distillery, I believe, at Tarlac, a town called Tarlac, and it had a distillery there, and when the Japanese took it, they didn't destroy the distillery, and when we took it back, we didn't destroy it, so we still could all drink Tarlac shellac. So that's the way that was. But this sunset mission, they came out, they had all the things there, all the records, all of our records, and aside, you could have your choice of flying back. If you were an airman, you could fly a B-24 back or whatever, they had the range, or you could go by ship. And so most of us wanted to fly back, so we did, and they assigned us to, people didn't know, our groups or our planes just kind of got mixed up. I didn't fly back with anybody, and my pilot, they just kind of mixed us. And
how did that make you feel? Were you
well?
Did you get a chance to say goodbye?
They had, they started used to had open circulation navigation. Then you could radio signal. You could get a route right away. So really, it didn't put me very busy for that. I did it, but they were using the radio route that way. So you get it back. We flew back to Muroc Air Force Base, which is now Edwards Air Force Base, where they have the spaceships land. But it was a Muroc Dried Lake, they called it then, and we landed there, and then flew us from there up to Mather Field, and then got us on a train to go to Richmond, California, which is outside San Francisco. It's a harbor. I don't know if Richmond is a town outside of San Francisco. And got a train together there, and to go to, and all of us who were headed east, we were going, if you were from Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan, you were going to Atterbury and south of Indianapolis. And I remember they put, I guess, 25 or 30 officers on a Pullman ship, a Pullman car. And I happened to, they put me on as the captain car chair of that chaplain, they put us on this car and had to make sure they got off and got food and all that. And we all got back to Atterbury in about 3 days, I guess. And
Had you been able to contact your family since being back in the States?
No, I didn't.
To let them know that you were...
Just told them to be coming home, but I didn't know where. And after that, I didn't have a phone or anything. And I believe I probably mentioned that when we got back at Atterbury, one fellow was getting off. His mother and father picked him up there in their car, and they were driving him to Lexington, I believe. So they said, well, they'd drive me to Louisville. So they did, and let me off at the corner, right up the corner from our house. And I went in, there was a little bar there in a deli, and asked them if I could use their phone, and I did, and I called my dad, and almost before I could hang up, he was running up the street. So it was a big, big greeting. And so it was a great ending for me to get back.
After you got back, was there any difference in how your parents treated you? I mean, you had been gone
for some years. No, it was, everything was fine. No, it was, no. And then Jack was gone then. Joe was still home, but Jack was
Jack,
gone.
So Jack, you made it back before Jack?
Yeah, because he had enlisted when he was in the Air Force as going to be a cadet, but then they stopped that and put him in as a military policeman on Enetuweetok. You know, if you're in Enetuweetok, mm-hmm. where they had the Adam test. So he was out there at Enetuweetok as a military policeman in that explosion out there. And I remember he had some things, and I remember he sent some of us, or they had sent as a thing that people that are due to get souvenirs, they had put a letter in to fly over this explosion, this atom bomb, and everybody would get a postmarked letter that just flew through the atom bomb mm-hmm. Smoke and such from it. So he got one of those, I remember. He had one since.
What about your friends, Max Archer?
Max came home. We were back together. He started at U of L. I started in January of 46 at U of L.
Were you the first one home?
Yeah, just pretty close to the same. I think I was the first one. No, or Max maybe was. But he went out, started up at U of L, and Roger did, and Roger had maybe he was a little earlier than me, got back a little sooner, maybe a few weeks, but he'd started at U of L in January, same time, but he joined Kappa Alpha Order, and we were always trying to do things together, so he talked me to coming over to Kappa Alpha House, and so I decided that'd be a good group to be with, and they were all vets, really, because about the only thing we came home to were young high school girls.
And it worked out for you.
Yeah. But anyway, I joined the Kappa Alpha. Max didn't. He didn't want to join in a fraternity, but he stayed at U of L, and he graduated, and while we were in the reserves together at Fort Knox. We flew out at Godman Field at Fort Knox to stay in the reserve Air Force. And we used to go out there about once a month and fly. And then during that time, the Korean War started, and Max was flying troop carrier planes when he was in the service out in Fort Knox. He was called a jungle jumper, and he flew from NADSEB all the way up to Philippines, dropping off air troopers, parachuters, and so they called him back, and a lot of pilots they called back. And so he left, and when he left, we'd already had our 3 years and a month of active service, and then we were both staying in the reserve, so he had then about close 8 to about 8 or 9 years. So when he got back into active duty, he wrote me and told me he was going to stay and make it a career. So he did, and he stayed and ended up in the Strategic Air Command. He used to write fly B-52s out over the Alaska and to the Russian border, and be always with an armed atom bomb and fly back to a field in Dakota. And so that's where he ended up flying that thing all the way to the retired. So he was carrying active atom bombs while they were flying out over around Alaska and over to the Russian air places. So he didn't do, that's all he did. But he enjoyed it. He always did. He did, when he first came back, he had one tough time, but he came back and when he got back in the service and got back from Korea, they put him in a fighter plane for a while just to learn to do it.
Yeah.
And he was in a plane down in Florida. Oh, I forget that name right now. But anyway, his plane had a, he was in a pilot's fighter plane. You can adjust the seat by a little notch.
Uh-huh.
And he put that down and it broke when he was landing, and it broke and it broke his back.
Oh.
So I went to see him down in Florida, and he had, he was all braced up for months, and he finally got all right. And then after that, he got well enough that he could go back and fly B-52s. So we got married. He was my best man at our wedding, and I was the best man at his wedding. And we used to visit one another. Last time he visited here was he was ended up retiring to Oregon at the Dells.
Mm-hmm.
And he came home here for the 50th anniversary of our high school. Male High 50th was in 1992, and he came back. We had a nice big get together, everybody that we hadn't seen for years, and that, and still see a few of them, but there are a few of them, but like Rogers did, and Max is, and they all are.
Mm-hmm.
But still some others, like there's one here named, we call him Hatchie, his name is Harrison Jones, and he's an attorney,
mm-hmm.
Harrison Jones, and still see him. And then two that were navigators, friends of mine, Dr. Carol Witten. Did you know Dr. Witten? He has two sons that are doctors here in Louisville, Witten's, W-I-T-T-E. But Carol was a KA, and he and Roger and KAs. But he had been, we went to the same navigator school. He was about two classes before me, and I was in 44, and I think he was in 43, and then Sidney Smith, he was a navigator, he went to Selman School too, but both of them were sent to Europe just a few months before me, and were shot down, and both were POWs. They came back. Carol was a doctor here, and Sid worked at Sears with me. He was merchandise manager here, and I replaced him, but then I went on to Cincinnati and some other places. He stayed in Louisville, and they both came back from POWs and had a tough time in that POW. They all shot down on their first mission, and but not hit, but the plane was crippled, and it landed around in Yugoslavia. In fact, Sid did, and Sid was trying to escape the underground system they had in Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
And they were helping him. They have an underground, Tito was his name, I believe. He had a underground escapeway. They tried to get him down to Greece, and they would get him to submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And he was out on that underground for about Well, see, I worked with him, so, and I think he was underground for about 4 or 5 days, and somebody turned him in, and so they marched him down to Africa, I mean to Germany, mm-hmm. and but I think the submarine, when they got down to the Mediterranean, they were off Greece. I think they took some of them by ferry over to Africa, South Africa bases, but he didn't get to the sub, and neither did Witten. They both ended up in about the same area for a prisoner camp.
Well, what did your, as you look back and you look at the rest of your life, what did your World War II service mean to you?
Oh, I thought it was glorious. Yeah, because to have been in a group like that and to look back and see what happened and see all that. I didn't know a bad guy. I didn't know a bad guy. In the basic training or at gunnery school or navigation school or pilots, everyone was great, you know. They were all just like that bunch there. And I've got some pictures of some of them at Kutztown. I told you we went to Kutztown State Teachers, and that group was good. It's just everywhere you went, they were just good people, and they were all enthusiastic. They all were there. I never saw anybody sad. They were all anxious to get home, but they were anxious to do what they were there for, and they every one of them did fantastic things. Yeah, proud of every one of them. Yeah, there was a good. I have no regrets, and only thing I have a regret now is how the country has gotten downhill. And it's really sad to see back to the type of fellows you grew up with and went to war with, and with the type of Congress we have now, which are, they don't give a damn about what happens as long as they get elected next 2 years. That's all they're really interested in. So it's given me a bad outlook that way. And most of my friends that are my age are feeling the same way. They feel that my two brothers, who were really right in the midst of everything too, when we get together, we just look to the future for this country. We're sorry for what our grandchildren are facing, and they, even though our granddaughter is smart and she gets to go to Harvard, we still feel sorry that it's not going to be a good future for her. She's just 22 or 21. She's just 21. And so it's a sad type to look like that. And I will say there are, but it's a deteriorating number of us. We're all going to church regularly. My brothers and our friends are all go to church on a regular basis. But that's a dwindling group too. It's a country that, a world that is just, I don't know what they're trying to do. So, so don't worry about it. There's nothing they can do about it. If that's what they want to do, they're going to do it. So you can't do anything about it, but I can still preach about it, but it doesn't do me any good.
You have a right to preach about it.
But you see that there's really, you look at the news in the morning TV. I watch it for about an hour in the morning. I always watch Fox because it, to me, it's the closest one to honesty that I can see. When I watch some of these stations, I wonder, some of these guys, how did they get elected? I can't believe they even graduated from college, some of them. So they really are, but they don't care.
Well, let's end this one on a happy note, since this recording is for the Library of Congress, but it's also a recording for your family.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Will I get one from both my boys?
Yes, we can make duplicate copies, but you've talked about what the war meant for you, and you've talked a little bit about your parents, especially your father. What is the lesson or lessons that your father passed to you that you want to leave for your children and your grandchildren, if you had advice to give them?
He just said, all he talked about were good things, and you know, we didn't. I got a couple of spankings, and we had a nice poplar tree with switches that a couple of times, I guess, my brothers and I, we had a few fights that we got switches on, but nobody sent them to jail or anything. They didn't say that was bad for giving us a switching, so you know, we accepted that because we deserved it. So, he just wanted us to continue to study, and he was glad we all went to college, and wanted us all to work hard. And my son, he told me, he said the only thing I really told him is, don't spend your money until you got it. He said, don't charge, go charging everything. I told Jim, just don't get yourself on a lot of charge cards and owe a lot of money. I said, just whatever you want, work to get it, but don't get yourself in debt for it. And that's what he's doing. He's done very well. I don't know, did you see that book review in his that had in the paper?
No, I didn't.
Would you want to see it? I got a copy of it just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, when we finish our interview.
Okay.
What is this? Go on here. Okay, you've shared with me your son's book and some reviews of his book. What about your other son?
Jeff? Jeff is my son. He's an attorney.
Oh, okay.
And graduated from Ohio State, got his bachelor's degree at Ohio State, and then law school at Louisville. And he had two friends at Perkins, was the big congressman from East Louisville, well named Perkins, and everything in eastern part of the state has Perkins on the hospitals and roads and everything. But this fellow Perkins' son went to U of L at the same time Jeff did, and they graduated, and Bobby Russell, they both thought they could own Eastern Kentucky if they go down to Eastern Kentucky and have practice, so that's what they did. Perkins went to Jackson, Kentucky, and Jeff to Campbellsburg, and Russell to Richmond. So they're still friends. Well, not Perkins. He ended up in jail. Remember when he was a congressman and he did some things with the post office?
Yes.
That was the son. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was with the older Perkins. And he ended up, they were the big Chicago congressman was in that. And Perkins got in on that, so he ended up in jail. He's now a preacher. He went to, when he got out, he went to theology school and this Presbyterian over in
Lexington Road.
On Lexington Road. Mm-hmm. So he's there, and Jeff talks to him every once in a while. We had a farm in Campbellsburg, and Perkins used to, he had a helicopter, and he used to fly in to see the Jim, or not Jim, Jeff. Mm-hmm. He fly in to talk to him, and he was a real nice kid, but he sure got off on the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing with me your
well,
that
was, you made, I'm a, you made me talk too much. I'm you couldn't. I probably used more tape than most people there.
Well, I don't know. You're my first interview.
Oh,
I think you did great, and thank you for sharing.
Well, I don't know. I hope my voice was all right.
It sounds just wonderful.
Okay, I'm in.